8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Hey, I can count to 14 or 15.
And Weibo.
I'm here. This is Charles Rust interviewing Bill Schwartz in Bozeman, Montana on November 16, 2005 about his World War II experiences. So, Bill, why don't you start off, tell us a little bit about your background before the war, how you went in, and then how things progressed from there.
All right, Charles. I grew up in eastern Montana at Weibo. My father in his time engaged in different kinds of work, including a 12-year stint as sheriff of Weibo County about the time I was in high school and college. Although these were difficult times financially, after being out of high school a year, I was able to enroll here at MSU.
What year did you graduate from high school, Bill?
I graduated in 1938.
Okay.
And it was in Montana State College, and my only goals were, I had an interest in science and mathematics, and I think I envisioned myself ending up as a high school teacher. I came to college as a single young man with no thoughts whatever of marriage at that time. After 3 years at MSC, World War II interrupted the education, and then I could see that service in the military was going to be a certainty. So after my junior year, during the summer, while I was a bus driver in Yellowstone Park, I went up to Butte and enrolled in the Army Air Corps, choosing to enter their meteorology program. This being a program where I could make use of the mathematics and physics that I had acquired in my 3 years at Montana State College. I was given the promise that by enrolling then, I could elect to be deferred until I graduated from college. I opted for this, and I went back to driving bus in the park. And 10 days or 2 weeks later, I got the telegram. In one respect, they did keep their promise. I indeed was given training in meteorology. First of all at UCLA, and then when a new class came and they were short of space, my class was sent to the University of Chicago to finish the program. And so in May of 1943, I given a certificate of proficiency in meteorology and a commission in the Army as a second lieutenant. Did you have any political leanings before the war, and what were they? I had no real interest in politics. My father was elected sheriff as a Republican, and that was about the extent of my my political interest. My daily concerns prior to the war, I can't recall any, except as I mentioned, finances kept me out of high school a year before enrolling at an institution of higher learning. My family's perception regarding military service was entirely favorable, and I certainly had their support. How did I believe I would say I had no family or close friends that affected my perception of the military in any way whatsoever. When it came time for me to enter the service, I was completely satisfied that this was something that had to be done, and I was not opposed in any way to being a participant. I have no particular feelings about the politics of the situation, or about isolation and that sort of thing. When I found out that Pearl Harbor was an attack, I was boarding at a place with a lot of fellow students, and when Sunday, one of the fellows told me the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, and it didn't register at all. It was just like he told me that he was going to go over to the store and buy a quart of chocolate milk, you know. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for this to sink in. Mm-hmm. I seem to remember that I did not believe in Jeanette Rankin's vote against the war, and I've already mentioned how I got involved with the military. I enlisted, as I mentioned. I've mentioned why I chose the Air Corps, with the particular area of meteorology. Was not influenced by any friends or family. I was not drafted, of course. How many people from your family or community were drafted since I was an only son? I had no immediate family that was drafted, of course, from our community. I knew quite a number of family and friends that were. And what were their reactions? I really don't. I don't know what their reactions were, because I was summoned to duty very short notice after being after enlisting, and I immediately had to get on a train and head for Los Angeles, since that was where I was first being sent. So I was into my training without any opportunity to visit about it with other friends or family in the same situation. Where did you do basic training? I was at UCLA for probably 8 months, and it was fortunate for me that as a as an aviation cadet in the service, I was still an enrolled student at UCLA, and I received university credit for my work in meteorology, and the same was true later at the University of Chicago. And I say this was fortunate because I entered the service with only a year to go for a bachelor's degree. And then later on, when I was overseas, I eventually proceeded to have those credits transferred to Montana State College, and I received a bachelor's degree from Montana State when I was overseas.
That's
so
great.
This aspect of my military service was worked out well. How was military life differ for you from civilian life? Some different, of course. In addition to being a university student as an aviation cadet, I, of course, was put into uniform and giving some training on how to march and how to do right shoulder arms and that sort of thing with a rifle.
Sure.
And, as a matter of fact, I encountered that during ROTC beforehand when I was in Bozeman at Montana State College.
Now, was ROTC required then in college in the 30s?
At my time, 2 years were required.
Yeah.
And of course, there was an advanced ROTC
sure.
program, which was elective, which I, however, did not elect. What did you do for recreation during basic training? We played a lot of softball, and our group of aviation cadets in my class at UCLA formed a basketball team, and we went over one night and played Caltech's basketball team and some things like that. Enjoyed meeting people from elsewhere around the country. It is true that at UCLA, most of my colleagues came from the western area of the U.S. And then, of course, at Chicago, I met many more people from other areas of the country. Incidentally, UCLA and the University of Chicago were just two of five universities that were giving this training in meteorology for Air Corps aviation cadets. What were my expectations as I prepared to leave basic training? I expected to be assigned for a short time in the U.S., but I certainly expected that I would eventually serve overseas. Where did I go at first? We were actually given some choice. In the United States, there were it was four or five weather regions, and I chose to go to the Northeast United States. One reason being that I've never been further east than Chicago, so I saw an opportunity there to see more of the United States, and also another reason I probably did this was that I felt that weather forecasting would be easier in that area of the United States. I learned in my training that weather forecasting is more difficult out here in these mountainous areas, where topographic effects affect the weather to a large extent. I was assigned to Bowman Field in Louisville, Kentucky, and I was there from March until May, and then I received orders to overseas. And I did not know at the outset where I was heading. All I knew that I was to leave Bowman Field and proceed to a place called Camp Anza, close to Riverside, California. And we went through the usual overseas preparations there. We were outfitted with clothing, equipment, and that sort of thing. And we didn't know immediately where we were heading overseas. When we got on the ship at the Los Angeles Harbor, I think we then realized that we were all headed for the China-Burma India Theater. And it was an interesting trip because of the danger of submarines. Our route was from Los Angeles direct to not Hawaii, which I would have enjoyed, but direct to Wellington, New Zealand. And after a day in Wellington.
How many days did it take you to get to Wellington?
I would expect 2 weeks or a little better from Los Angeles to Wellington. And then, it seems strange, but from Wellington, New Zealand, we didn't head straight across the Tasman Sea to Australia. No, we went down below the South Island of New Zealand. I judged that at that point we were only about 1,000 miles from the Antarctic continent. Mm-hmm. And then we turned east. We crossed the Tasman Sea, which was quite rough weather. We went below Tasmania up into Melbourne, was in the harbor at Melbourne for a couple days, and then we went below Australia over to the west coast, stopped at Perth, got to spend a day in Perth, Australia.
That should have been fun after all that time at sea.
Yes, that, as I said, in Melbourne, we were allowed to get out and stretch our legs mm-hmm. by running around on the docks, mm-hmm. but we didn't get to visit the city. From Perth, Australia, then we headed across the Indian Ocean to Bombay. This was a rather long jaunt, and what made it even longer was the fact that we sailed a zigzag course because of the submarine mm-hmm. danger. But after 5 weeks or so on the boat, we docked in Bombay, spent two or three days there, got to visit the city, and then we were put on a British ship for 2 days, disembarked at Karachi, then a part of India, but of course mm-hmm. that now is Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And then after a couple weeks at a British depot out of Karachi, a ways in the desert, then we eventually got transported to the bases we were assigned to, and in my case, I was assigned to the weather station at a base in India, about 200 miles north of Calcutta, and then after an interesting but routine 16 months in India. I got orders to proceed to northern Burma. In northern Burma, my job was to set up the first weather station in reoccupied Burma. The Japanese, of course, held most all of Burma, and they, of course, held a good portion of the Burma Road, so we had no land route into China. And I was setting up this weather station at a place on the so-called Lido Road. This road was being constructed from the Assam Valley in India to join up with the upper part of the Burma Road that was not under the control of the Japanese, and thus would give us a ground route into China, so that all our supplies didn't have to be flown over the so-called hump, very high section of the Himalayas.
Primary purpose of your weather station was to broadcast weather for the pilots or flying over it?
The station I set up at Xingbuyang in northern Burma. It always seemed strange to me. This place had a name, but there was no village.
Well, be darned.
No village there at all. And I was there for close to 3 months, but very glad to leave because when it got to be May, we were in the onset of the monsoon season. And even though the monsoon was just getting going well, the mud was in places a couple feet deep. The jeeps were grounded and only the big trucks could get around. I'm very pleased to get orders then to go over to China. Of course, this was transportation by air, flying the hump. It was the most spectacular flight of my life, and I was pleased that we went over to Kunming on a perfectly clear day, and I felt safer, but of course it was scenery-wise, this was an extremely scenic flight. Well, I spent the last 16 months of the war in China. Oh, let's see. I'm scanning the questions. Did you see combat? Not really. Not really. When I was in northern Burma, there was a skirmish overhead one day between some Japanese Zeros and our P-40 fighter planes that were based there. Later on, at weather stations in China, we learned that the Chinese only bombed on moonlight nights, and occasionally on a moonlight night, we would hear the alert, and that would mean jump out of bed, jump into your pants, and run out and jump in the slit trenches, mm-hmm. just to be safe. Mm-hmm. And so I heard a few bombs burst, but no, I really did not see combat, and fortunately spent no time in captivity. How did I stay in touch with my family? Well, only by writing letters. Very different than what we see now. I understand that now we send email to our soldiers and maybe even talk with them on the telephone.
Yeah.
Not then. We had what was called V-mail, of course. Mm-hmm. Our letters were copied and they were shrunk in size.
Oh, yeah.
to save bulk, and so we wrote letters and got email letters. What was the food like? Well, in India and China, or rather in India and northern Burma, there were no complaints about the food, as I already mentioned. We did not have to depend on air transportation for food and supplies like we did in China.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, everything in China had to be airlifted over the hump. So as far as food is concerned, it's true that we did have, if we were traveling on a plane, we did have available C rations and K rations, but otherwise at our bases, we had to live off the land.
Mm-hmm.
One of my first bases in China was in was relatively far north in China, and one of our staples was water buffalo, which is not choice meat. And, one of our vegetables was cabbage, which had obviously been frozen, and I've never seen frozen cabbage in the supermarket. I'm sure it's true that freezing ruins cabbage. So that winter in northern China wasn't too good in that respect. Did I feel pressure or stress in my job? Yes, to some extent. I've mentioned that first base I was at in China was relatively close to part of China that was held by the Japanese, and therefore we were unable to get much in the way of weather reports from the north or from the northwest.
Mm.
And during the winter months, of course, in the northern hemisphere, much of the weather moves out of the north and northwest. And this made forecasting at times quite difficult. We had one reporting station that did give us weather reports from a place to the far northwest up on the Great, at the Great Wall of China. But the difficulty of forecasting was a reason for some pressure. For example, at our base, we had in addition, we had a B-25 light bomber squadron. We had a squadron of P-40 fighter planes, but we also had a photo reconnaissance squadron. Now, our photo reconnaissance pilots flew those twin fuselage P-38s. And for safety, they had no guns, and they just simply depended on high altitude and speed for safety. Well, our photo recon pilots would fly as far as the big city, which is now known as Beijing, but during World War II it was called Peking. Prior to World War II, I seem to remember that the name was Peking, but everybody knows about the big city Beijing, and we would our pilots, when they would fly to Peking, they were in the saddle for probably nine hours or more. Well, sometimes during that 9 hours, the weather would turn bad and wouldn't exactly agree with the information you'd given them on takeoff, and there were times when you literally sweat blood until they were safely back on the ground.
How did you gather the kinds of information you needed on weather? You said you had a station reporting from the wall, but what the whole fact
we had reports from all our weather stations in India, Burma, and China that were not in areas controlled by the Japanese. Maybe I should mention the overall picture. The China Burma India Theater was served by the 10th Weather Squadron. This is a vast area, of course, Southeastern Asia, India, Burma, and China. Our squadron headquarters was in Calcutta, we had, of course, considerable personnel in the areas of China that were not occupied by the Japanese, and we had a headquarters detachment in southwestern China at Kunming, and it was unwieldy. personally, it had this effect. The further you were stationed from headquarters, the longer it took you to get a promotion. I'm about to where the war was over. Maybe in a lighter vein, I could drop back and make a few remarks might be of interest in a lighter vein. I've mentioned that in northern Burma, I was not even close to any village or any center of population. Around our airstrip, we did see a lot of the native Kachins. Found it rather amusing there. We'd have a little light liaison plane, an L-4 or something like that, parked at the airstrip. And you'd see two or three of these native Kachins emerge from the jungle with a bamboo stick in their hands, maybe 3 feet long. They'd walk up to that airplane and they would carefully measure its dimensions, the wing length, the length of the fuselage, in particular, and they were harmless and weren't doing any damage. And I always wondered, what are they trying to do back there in the jungle? Are they trying to build an airplane?
Yeah.
but in Indian China, I had much more interaction with the with Indian people and the Chinese mm-hmm. people. And in I noticed one basic difference. In India, of course, is a poverty-ridden nation.
Yes.
And in India, there was much begging by the young children. Let me interrupt myself, Charlie. Am I being too long-winded?
No, this is fine. I'm just
didn't ask at the outset.
No time limit. I'm going to have to turn the tape, but shortly. But
I'll move along with the things that I found interesting and amusing.
That's great.
In India, the majority of the people begging were the small children. On the streets, they ran up to you with their hands outstretched, saying, "Bakshish Saab, Bakshish Saab," yeah. Meaning, give me a handout, a donation. I was amused the very first day I set foot in India. We got off the ship, as I mentioned, in Bombay, and about three or four of us fellas, we engaged a horse-drawn vehicle called a gharry, probably held, four passengers or so, and we just hailed down this gharry and we just jumped in, and we of course have no destination in mind. We just wanted to go see something in the city. So we got on this gharry close to the docks and we set out, and in no time, here were two or three little children running. They had to run to keep up with the progress of the gharry, and they were running on the street alongside of us, hollering, "Bakshi Saab." Well, one of the people in our group had already acquired some Indian coins, and I doubt if the fellow even knew what they were worth. Of course, the basic money unit in India was the rupee. It was then worth about 32 cents. And there were 16 annas in a rupee. And so an anna was a coin worth about 2 cents. And there actually were coins called half annas, worth about a penny in our money. And this fellow grabbed a coin out of his pocket, and I don't think he even knew what it was worth, and he handed it to the kid. And the little fellow was highly insulted. He said, "No half anna, Saab, no half anna." And I swear that little fellow ran for a half a mile along with us, along that gharry, protesting, "No half anna, Saab." Well, anyway, getting back, one more comment on...
Just a minute, I'm going to turn it over here. And this finishes side one of the interview with Bill Swartz. I'm going to turn it over to side two.